This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vasilash, episode 454 for March 1st, 2019. Tractors, airplanes, and other things you don't know about Ford. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLine.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific Time. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine in iTunes, Stitcher, or on YouTube.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems. And by BorgWarner, propulsion solutions that support a clean, energy-efficient world.
Thanks for joining us. John's on assignment, so you get me. It's going to be a great show we're going to have this afternoon for you all. So we brought Christy Schweinsberg from WardsAuto.com. Christy, good to see you again.
Good to see you, Gary.
How you been?
I've been great. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks for being here. Greg Migliori, who is the editor-in-chief of Autoblog.
Good to be here.
Thank you. And just so you all know, I mean, you guys got to go to their, after the show, go to their websites, look at what they do, WardsAuto.com, Autoblog.com. They'll appreciate it. You'll appreciate it. And it's a good thing for everyone. So check it out because they do outstanding work, both of them. I know them and they do. But our special guest here today is Bob Krupke, who was the Ford corporate historian, 44 years at the Ford Motor Company. Mm-hmm. And we'll be talking to you. So here's the thing. Get your questions in. Send them via email. It'll be viewermail@autoline.tv, or you can do it via the YouTube chat, or you can call us at 1-620-288-6546, 1-620-288-6546, and leave a brief question for us. So here's what we're going to do. For the first half of the show, we're going to talk to Bob all about the history of Ford. So for those of you who have questions about the history of the company, okay, we're not going to be talking about what Ford is doing right now because he's a historian and historians look to the history. And then for the second half of the show with Greg and Christy, we will talk about what's going on. And so maybe if you have some questions about Ford or Ford products, that maybe one of these two will have some good insights for you on that subject. So, Bob.
Yes.
44 years with a company that arguably has some of the most fascinating history in terms of developing the auto industry.
Absolutely.
So what is your take as you look back at the history of this company, that company?
Sure.
What are some of the key moments?
Well, obviously the key moments, a lot of them early in the Ford Motor Company's history, the invention of the integrated moving assembly line for automobiles, that was a game changer. The $5 workday for an 8-hour workday, that was amazing, too.
And these took place about when?
These all took place 1913, 1914, very early on. And like I said, they changed everything. They changed the way people lived and people worked, and they were the foundation for the middle class in America. It's an amazing history. And then, of course, just things kept adding on to that history. But it's looking at it from my perspective, it's amazing because it was I could see cyclical things, just like life is. You know, there's many things that come back again. Working with suppliers, keeping it inside, going back to, you know, mm-hmm. all of those type of policies mm-hmm. and so on that went on. But overall, you know, it was a way to give people personal mobility. Mm-hmm. And we still have it today.
So I mean, one of the things that has always fascinated me about Henry mm-hmm. Ford was the fact that he wasn't always successful at the start.
No. Henry Ford was an interesting person. He was streetwise. You know, they always compare the group of guys that hung together, Edison and Henry and Firestone and Burroughs. And it's quite interesting that Edison and Henry Ford were uneducated, and Burroughs and Firestone were educated. They had gone to higher schooling. But Henry Ford seemed to know how to rally the troops. He always had, in my assumption from reading, the best people joined the company. And I think it was because he did let them go. And he always had a motto, which I really respected. I like, because probably I failed a lot. But he always said, you know, if you don't fail, you're not doing your job. You know, failure is how we learn. And I thought that was pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, before the Ford Motor Company, I mean, he grew up in what we now know as Dearborn, Michigan.
That's correct.
And he was basically a kid who lived on a farm.
Absolutely. He lived on that farm, and his mother died when he was very young. And that affected him. The other thing that people don't probably realize a lot, but when he was born, 1863, the Civil War was just kind of brewing and coming to an end. But he grew up with all those uncles coming back, telling him these stories about the Civil War and that. He actually was very patriotic, you know, unbelievably so, because he had heard all of those stories and that. And he also was very attuned, being a farm kid, to nature. And all through his life, he was really about nature, you know.
But why did he invent a car? Where would that come from?
Well, you know, that's interesting that you state that. And there's different thoughts on that. He himself believed that he was reincarnated, because he and Edison never could figure out. They never could figure out why they had that gift. You know, why do we know this? We shouldn't know this because we're not really subject. My dad wasn't a blacksmith or anything. Part of it was Henry's intuition, and perhaps the audience has heard, he was really into, like, fixing watches and strange things when he was very young, not solar ones, but he was fixing geared ones, you know. And he was really into mechanics, and then he saw steam tractors operating, and he loved the thought that there could be a machine that operated on its own. And the other thing that didn't hurt, he hated horses all of his life. He was kind of afraid of them.
So. All right, so speaking of that, we got a question from the audience from Brett S. from Madison, Wisconsin, and he says his grandfather was a salesman of Ford Farm Equipment in West Bend, Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you just mentioned that he was interested in tractors.
Oh, yes.
So at one point, the Ford Motor Company was in the farm implement business?
Oh, tractors. We started in the tractor business back in the teens and the early 20s, and we built a tractor called a Fordson. And long before there were John Deere's and Farmalls and Internationals and all that, the mass-produced tractor that was on the market was the Fordson. And they're still running today.
Mm-hmm.
They're amazing. I mean, you'd never use them probably on a farm, but they're, you know.
So was this basically like a real tractor, or did he somehow modify a Model T and make it a tractor?
Well, they tinkered around with a lot of those ideas, putting half tracks on the Model Ts and so on. But no, this was a real tractor. Real tractor. Those big, that, by gosh, they've got a model. That's a Fordson.
That looks like a Fordson, yeah.
Yep, that's a Fordson.
So did you guys know that they made tractors?
I do now.
You do know?
I do now. I think there's a high school in this area called Fordson, and their logo is the tractor.
Yeah. I don't think it was named after the tractor, and the tractor might have been named after the school, because the school is very old. I don't know for sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But those Fordson tractors, and then as time went on, we built an 8-end tractor and a 9-end tractor, and those famous gray and red ones that you see out in every old farm field across America. Those really put the farmer on wheels.
Mm-hmm. So the Model T basically stayed in production for
19 years.
Okay, so till 1927 when they basically stopped producing that thing.
That's correct.
Okay. So essentially the same car.
Yes.
Okay, not like we have now where
No.
The mid-cycle refreshes and...
We had one car,
why?
11 models. 11 models of that same car. I think because Henry was so successful with the Model T touring car, he said, hey, we don't need to have other brands. Now, we did in 1922 by Lincoln Motor, because his son convinced him we didn't have any luxury cars in our stable. We had all these different variations of Model Ts, but no luxury car. So that's when we branched out and bought Lincoln Motors. So we basically had two brands, you know, but nothing else. Not like a General Motors or a Chrysler, which engulfed other brands in their stable.
Bob, you were mentioning, like, we didn't know that, you know, really that Ford made tractors, at least not to that depth of knowledge, which is cool. We were talking off camera how they made submarine chasers, right?
Yes.
Too.
Yes.
This is World War One, and I guess they were kind of like swift boats or something, right?
Yeah, they were actually like a minesweeper. They were designed because the Germans already had U-boats even back in World War One, and they were playing havoc with the merchant marines. So Henry got a government contract to build ships. Built them down at where the present Rouge plant is. That was the start of it all, and we put in steel making. So after the war, it was logical that we did something with it. So we started making a lot of the parts for the Model T, ship them across town to the Highland Park plant. And then, as we mentioned, the Model T came to an end in 27, and when we switched over to the Model A, we moved everything to the Rouge plant, and we used the old steel making, and that was the beginnings of vertical integration, where you tried to build the car, Henry did, from the raw materials right to the end.
So if my math is correct, Henry was 40 when he started Ford Motor Company?
That's correct.
That's kind of an advanced age, especially back then when life expectancy wasn't very long.
You're absolutely right.
So how was he making a living prior to starting Ford?
Well, he did lots of things. He repaired watches. He worked for several early automobile companies, the Detroit Automobile Company, and then he formed another company called the Henry Ford Corporation. We don't even have any pictures or anything of that because that only lasted 5 months or something. Mm-hmm. And then he got into car racing, which is finally how he got his backing to start the Ford Motor Company. They said, hey, this kid, he wasn't a kid, this 40-year-old knows his automobiles. Mm-hmm. You know, and they backed him, and in 1903, the rest is history.
Hmm. So before we leave the tractor entirely, Wright Knight 70 says, was it true the flathead V8 was based around two Ford tractor I-4s?
They used those as prototypes, and they put those together to try to get the power that they needed, and they worked on that. I believe they weren't V8s, though. Because way back then, we didn't have a V8. It would have been they put two fours together.
So it would have been like an I-8.
And it was long.
That's a big engine.
Yeah. Engine.
Well, those old engines, you know, had huge pistons.
Yeah.
You know, lots of torque, not a lot of speed.
Boy, know? And this time, this is just came in. Kit Gerhardt wants to know, he says, the 32 Ford flathead V8 was credited with bringing performance to the masses, but by the specs, it didn't seem that much more powerful than a Chevy or Plymouth 6. So what was the reality? Did the 32 Ford V8 outperform other engines?
Well, according to Clyde Barrow, it did. Bonnie and Clyde, we have a letter in the archives, and they wrote to Henry Ford and said, you know, this is the best getaway car we've ever been able to steal.
Really?
And it's kind of interesting. It's hard to authenticate the handwriting and that, but seems to be true. Bottom line on it is the V8 engine, the mass-produced. The key about that 1932 V8 engine was that it was the first time anybody could mass-produce them. General Motors had a V8 engine, Packard, everybody knew how to make a V8 engine. The trick was GM could only make 4,000 of them economically a year. Henry Ford had just committed to making 5,000 a day. So it was like, oh, my gosh.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there's a fascinating story about the press conference he had where he announced that because nobody knew he was going to say that in 1931. And several of the chief engineers passed out in the back of the room because they couldn't figure out how they were going to do it.
Well, so he just basically said, we're going to.
Yes, because he didn't like the fact that GM was surpassing our sales.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the engineers at Ford said, well, we got to make a six-cylinder engine like GM has. And he didn't like that. So by surprise at a press conference, and they were primitive press conferences, but they didn't have electronics. But they went to it, and he stood up there. And right away, the first question from the reporters was, what's new for 1932, Mr. Ford? What are you going to do? And he said, I'm going to put a V8 engine standard in all of our cars. And with that, like I said, several of the engineers passed out because they couldn't figure out how to do it. And they finally solved it in the foundry. They cast it in block,
mm-hmm.
you know, one-piece casting, which was very tricky because there was a lot of little water jackets and mm-hmm. stuff that had to go in there. So anyways, mm-hmm. but it put us 6 years ahead of our competition.
Wow. So there's a lot of agricultural interest here. Jeff Rainey says, there are a lot of stories and rumors about how Henry Ford wanted the Model T for the self-sufficient farmer. Did mm-hmm. he have any visions of it running on multi-fuels, and is there any evidence of farmers powering their cars successfully with
absolutely
gasoline?
Absolutely. Henry Ford demanded that those Model Ts, especially the early ones, be able to run on both kerosene for the farmer and gasoline. You have to picture that when cars first came into being, there wasn't a gas station on every block and no convenience stores. They literally were all using kerosene rurally
mm-hmm.
for their tractors and stuff. So when the Model Ts came out, he just tweaked the carburetor so it could burn on multi-fuels.
It's interesting how history kind of repeats itself here.
Absolutely.
Like infrastructure problems,
absolutely.
Executives who say things off the cuff. You know,
No. Yeah. It's very
people
true.
People fainting in the back of the room.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, as when you asked me that first question, what did I learn? I learned that most things are cyclical.
Yeah,
they just keep
absolutely.
Happening. They're happening today.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
In the early years of the company,
yes.
What was the pundit's take on the company? I mean, were they expected? Was Ford expected to succeed? I mean, you know, today we've got critics all over the place of
sure.
every automaker. What was sure. it like back then?
Well, it's very fascinating. Our early board of directors had some unbelievable people in them, you know. They had the Dodge brothers mm-hmm. were on our board of directors, Rackham, and a bunch of different people. But at the heart of it was making money.
Mm-hmm.
Same business premises today. And yes, they were sure that they were on to something. And Henry Ford did convince them that he could build these things kind of on mass production eventually. But it was James Cousins who was the one that kept prodding Henry. Henry never liked the car to come out the end of the plant unless it was perfect. And James Cousins said, listen, we got to sell some of these things. We got to get them out there. You know, and that's not to say they let them go without good quality. But you know what I'm saying? If nobody got a chance to see these things, you were a basement band, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
So Tony Gray wants to know, why did Ford abandon the iconic blue oval logo for decades using the complicated crest design for a period of time and, you know, then brought the...
Right. Well, you know, that is an excellent question. And brand managers could probably answer this better than I can. To the best of my ability, I have to tell you that I've learned that you take away something knowing you're going to bring it back. You know, oh, boy, I'm going to change the Coke formula. And then let's bring it back now. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that happens. The crest that he's mentioning engulfed Ford, Lincoln Mercury, and tractor division. It was representative of the different divisions. And part of that, I believe, was done for our 50th anniversary. Mm-hmm. And it was something special.
Is the script Ford, is that Henry's autograph or is that?
No. Okay. No, that was designed by Wills, a man named Wills that worked for Henry. And Wills' dad was a graphic artist and had an old stencil kit from Germany. And that's where that comes from.
Everybody's a designer, right?
That's like, right. That's right.
And a writer. Right.
It's just sort of hilarious when he busts out the stencil kit, right?
You mean, oh, yeah.
And now it's just like, you know, legendary.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just like.
Everybody thought that was Henry's signature, but it's not.
That's very unusual. Amato RCO wants to know, is there any information that perhaps isn't well known about the Ford-Ferrari deal that did not happen?
Well, that dates back to the 65 Le Mans race. And that's where Henry Ford challenged Ferrari to that race. And, you know, Americans weren't very good at those foreign races and that because they were different kind of style racing and all that. But Henry Ford challenged him, and people may not know this, but Ford managed to come in 1, 2, 3 in that race and beat the pants off Ferrari. And they had a lot of dialogue. Henry Ford II, this is, the deuce, and the chairman of Ferrari. And we never did partner with Ferrari. In fact, what we did is we bought Aston Martin back then when that was stewing and brewing, and we owned them for several years.
Mm-hmm. I was talking with a coworker. He just got finished reading a book about the Arsenal of Democracy, and he was talking about the contentious relationship between Henry and Edsel, particularly around the time of World War II. Henry was anti-war. Edsel was, I don't know if you'd say pro-war, but I was just wondering if you could speak to their complicated relationship.
Henry Ford was a pacifist and did lots of unusual things, including chartering a peace boat back in World War I. It failed terribly and muddled up a lot of politics, and people were mad at him and stuff. But nevertheless, he was a pacifist. He had befriended Charles Lindbergh, who also was a pacifist. And when it came to World War II, Henry was very reluctant. Henry was mad for several reasons. One, he told the government, hey, I thought you took care of this in World War I. Here we are again fighting the same, And Edsel Ford was actually trying to take a lead in the company with products and keeping the company going. You got to remember, Henry Ford was an old man by World War II.
Yeah.
And a lot of people, I just wanted to state for my sake, for the record, Edsel Ford and Henry Ford are often misunderstood. People think that he wasn't nice to his son in that. But I'm here to tell you that they did everything together. Mm-hmm. And I had the great chance of talking to Henry Ford II and William Clay Ford. And both of them said, no, my dad and grandpa were just like this. Hmm. You know, they called each other twice a day, always when they lived. You know.
So Edsel was Henry's only son.
That is correct.
And one of the fascinating things you were talking about, you know, the idea of, okay, we're going to put out a, you know, bazillion engines, you know, per day, that he ended up building a plant out in Ypsilanti that put out more bombers than the entire aircraft manufacturing community on the West Coast could even dream of.
Right. Several things, and Edsel was very instrumental in Willow Run. In fact, that's one of the things that is sad. You know, Henry Ford appointed Edsel to be the general manager of that bomber plant out in Ypsilanti. And as you probably know, that's where he got sick. And he collapsed out there, and they took him to Henry Ford Hospital. He only lived 2 more weeks. He had stomach cancer. And Henry Ford, even though he was old and maybe senile then, he blamed himself for having his son worked so hard, mm-hmm. you know, in the last few days of his life. Mm-hmm. And he was never the same after that. Henry Ford, you know, kind of gave up on everything. But making a long story short, that arsenal of democracy, you know, I could talk for hours on that. But Jeeps and those B-24 airplanes won World War II.
Right.
If it wasn't for Detroit and the Ford Motor Company, we would have lost the war. In fact, Roosevelt said that.
Mm-hmm.
He sent a letter to all the prominent business people and big companies and said, we are going to lose World War II if we can't protect our troops and get them mobile so they can move. So we jumped on the bandwagon, and that, you see, a lot of people don't realize, but we, the Ford Motor Company, way back in the 20s, started building metal airplanes, the Ford Tri-Motors, and we revolutionized. We had the first concrete runways in America, the first passenger terminal, delivered the first airmail, and delivered the first passengers around the United States, and built this unbelievable metal airplane. Bill Stout designed it. It was incredible. So it wasn't surprising that we bid on that B-24. And that was a Ripley's Believe It or Not story, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We got that contract because we said we could build that airplane quicker than Consolidated, who had the contract, and McDonnell Douglas and Boeing and all that. And we did. In fact, we got it down to one an hour,
wow.
one plane an hour.
And I understand the living and working conditions at Willow Run, because they had people yeah. living on the property that
yes.
were very dire in the early, early days.
We had to import all these employees. Got to remember, most of the men and a lot of the women in Detroit were already working,
right.
building war goods in that.
Mm-hmm.
So our pot that we had to get, we'd go down south and truck people up from the south to work in the plants. But there was no housing for them.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to build these little shacks and all that.
Right.
It got better just as the war was ending. But up until then, it was rough going.
So we have a phone call from mm-hmm. one of our viewers, Clem. So could we please bring that in?
Now, this is Kleb Zorowski in Delmont, Pennsylvania. My question is, why was Ford so late putting hydraulic brakes on their cars? I mean, when I was a kid, I had a 1934 Dodge that had hydraulic brakes. Thank you.
Bye. Sure. Well, that's a good technical question. Part of that was to do with Henry Ford. And Henry Ford really could be quite stubborn when it came to machinery. He always believed that the three successes to automobiles was durable, simple, and affordable. So any change like that, especially shifting from mechanic to more automatic, he always kind of bucked that a little bit. And I think that's why it was so slow. The other reason, too, that I've got to tell you, and I don't know the answer, but a lot of those innovations, just like today, depend on who owns the patents.
Mm.
Who controls those patents? Because if you got to buy a widget and it's more than you can charge for it, it doesn't always work,
mm-hmm.
as you can imagine.
So I've learned a lot just sitting here. This has been really interesting. Is there like a forgotten chapter of Ford's history? Somebody, you know, who's just maybe not as well known as perhaps like the Ford family, but who is really, you know, instrumental in, you know, the development of the company?
Well, I think that often his own son gets forgotten
sure.
of how much he contributed. And they made a great pair because Henry was mechanical and streetwise. Edsel was educated and arty. He was in the design. Mm. And he was the one that brought a lot of the design innovation to the cars and urged us to do wild-looking prototypes and all of that stuff. And it worked out kind of cool. And I'm sure that his dad would kind of go, oh, gosh, what's that, you know, or something. Because he even resisted moving from the Model T to the Model A in 1928. But you know what? He did listen to his son. And I thought it worked out pretty good. So he was, I think, always forgotten in this equation. You remember Charlie Sorensen. You remember Lee Iacocca. You remember a lot of the characters that have worked for Ford Motor Company. And they all contributed. If there's one thing that I admired about Henry Ford is he wasn't afraid to hire somebody that knew more than even he did and cultivated him and said, go to it. Do what you got to do. And I think that was one of our main successes. I do.
Well, Bob, we didn't get past 1965, and so we could, you know, go for hours on this. But I want to thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much.
Online After Hours. It's been fascinating.
Very cool.
Very interesting.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. So we're going to take a quick break. We're going to hear from our friends at Bridgestone, BorgWarner, Lear, and then we're going to come back with the Dr. Data and quiz these two. So,
right. The world is changing at an ever-increasing pace. No matter what the mode of transportation, there is always the need for an efficient propulsion system. And that's exactly what BorgWarner has been doing since the earliest days of the automotive industry. We create innovative mobility technologies that reduce energy consumption and emissions while improving performance. Our proven track record has made us an industry leader in forward-looking propulsion solutions for combustion, hybrid, and electric vehicles.
Lear Kinexus offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Okay, and we're back. So, Christy, Greg, it's time for the Dr. Data segment. So, this one, I mean, it's going to be slam dunk.
Okay.
Okay, so it'll be clearly explained. So Katie, please bring up the first slide. Okay, so there's a advertising marketing research firm, Havas, and so each year they do a meaningful brand study. So what does meaningful brand mean? So a meaningful brand is something that has impact on personal and collective well-being and functional benefits. So they surveyed 350,000 people in 31 markets to determine which brands would be meaningful brands.
Okay.
Okay, got that?
Yep.
Okay, so next slide, please. So of the top 30 meaningful brands, okay, these are all types of brands, every consumer product you can imagine. Which automotive brands made the list?
I'm going to say this is a trick question, and no automotive brands made the list.
That's good. I wish I hadn't thought of this.
Good guess. That's like an SAT question. None of the above. I'm going to say Toyota, Tesla, and Chevy.
If I had to pick.
and you do have to pick, Christy.
Okay, I'd say Porsche, BMW, Mercedes, Tesla.
You're keeping score. I was going to say history was my favorite subject, and math, this is kind of quantitative, was my least favorite.
So here we can see that there was actually came in third, came in eighth, came in 11th, and came in 29th.
Okay.
So does that help any?
I'm sticking with mine. I feel pretty good.
So Porsche, yeah. BMW, Mercedes, Tesla, and Christy, you had Toyota.
No, that was me.
Oh, Toyota.
Yeah, that was me.
Wait a minute. Toyota, Tesla.
And Chevy. So I should
Porsche,
add
Porsche, BMW, Mercedes, yeah. Tesla.
I would add Ferrari to that.
You'd add Ferrari.
Yeah.
So we won't go through. So what would be the top of all of those? So we're not going to go into the.
I'm going to say Tesla.
You're going to say Tesla. So number three, Tesla from Christy.
I'm going to say Toyota. I just feel like probably the West Coast kind of.
But
like
this is the
loyalist.
Whole world.
The whole world?
Whole world.
Ooh. So that makes
I
me.
I change my answer.
Yeah, okay. That makes me second guess.
All right.
Let me put. I got to put Volkswagen in there somewhere.
I was
somewhere.
Just thinking that. Okay. Yeah, Volkswagen.
Because they're huge in South America.
Uh-huh.
I'll take out Mercedes and put Volkswagen.
Okay.
All right. So I will add Volkswagen too, but I'm going to drop. I think I said Ferrari.
Yes.
Yeah, I got to drop the prancing horse.
All right. So Okay. And you guys actually didn't do badly here.
Okay.
Except for as you're going to see in a moment here, Christy. So, Katie, bring up the real answer. So the third top is Mercedes. So it's Mercedes, BMW, Audi, which none of you got.
Yeah.
And way down there at 29 is Toyota.
Wow. Okay.
Isn't that really a surprise?
I think it is, because what I think of, like, these are really mainstream consumer goods. You know, you're like Google, Heinz, things that impact everybody at every walk of life. You know, Mercedes certainly has a meaningful brand, but, I mean, that's more of a 1% kind of thing.
Right.
So.
But you aspire to own a Mercedes or BMW.
Yeah.
Those are brands sung about in music, you know.
All right. So speaking of Mercedes and BMW, so we heard that they have decided that they're going to be taking their mobility services. So they're going to be taking Reach Now, Charge Now, Free Now, Park Now, and putting all of these things together. And we've heard today, I believe it was that basically they said, we're going to join together in terms of developing autonomous technology for vehicles. Mm-hmm. Okay. So here we have mobility and autonomy, like two of the pillars of the contemporary auto industry. Here are what I would imagine would be two competitors. What's going on? I mean, how
stuff's expensive. I mean, you gotta spread the costs around, the R&D costs around, and maybe put some heads together, because this is a whole new thing. I mean, the idea that people are gonna ride share and ride hail and not have a personal vehicle in the garage. You've got to come up with whole new business models.
So then we also heard Volkswagen and Ford. Now, there was reporting that said that Volkswagen was going to be investing $1.7 billion in Ford's autonomous Argo AI thing. Phoebe Wall-Howard reported in yesterday's Free Press that maybe that's not going to be happening, at least not anytime soon. But again, we did have that deal with Volkswagen and Ford where they're on commercial vehicles, which is like, okay. But again, two strong competitors getting together. Is it just money?
Money and talent. I mean, there's a huge demand for software engineers. You know, Detroit and Germany and all the other automotive centers are fighting for talent with Silicon Valley and other places where technology companies are luring them. So, you know, maybe Mercedes and BMW together, Ford and Volkswagen together, you know, it might tip somebody who's weighing, you know, Google with Ford. I don't know. My theory.
What do you think, Greg?
I kind of think maybe nobody quite has the strategy pinned down yet. Everybody's kind of playing around the edges. So by working with a partner, you can sort of hedge your bets. And then if you get it partially right, well, okay, you got it 50% right, 50% wrong, but you split the bet, if you will, with Mercedes and BMW. You know, they're not taking on that full, you know, cost of trying to make the investments in these things, which are pretty risky. You know, we're talking about changing business models, ways of life, ways we buy and sell vehicles. So I think what they're trying to do is sort of guard against, you know, potential pitfalls, things that might go wrong. And I mean, that's what I look at when I see these, you know, very strange partnerships, you would say, sort of coming together, because they don't have all the answers.
So, you know, it seems to me that, mobility is, in terms of ride hailing, I mean, it's a thing, right? I mean, there's no question about that. That's going to continue. I mean, we hear about Uber and Lyft doing IPOs. And so it's not entirely surprising that car companies would say, well, we want to do this, because, as you say, Christy, that you're going to have a new revenue stream somehow or another, and if people are going to be not buying cars, you might as well try to make whatever money you can off the what's remaining. But the thing I begin to wonder about more and more is the reality of level four autonomy. Okay, so the deal with BMW and Mercedes are saying, you know, oh, we're going to develop level four autonomy, which basically means, you know, no steering wheel, no pedals, and it can drive around by itself, but within a defined area, within a geofenced area. You know, I'm thinking, you know, unless we're talking Walt Disney World, it's not likely to happen. And I just wonder whether these people are not making these tremendous bets because it seems cool.
Oh, it's to please Wall Street. I mean, and Wall Street thinks that's cool. So, yeah, I think that's a huge part of it. Absolutely.
There was a study recently. I forget who did it, but it basically said, you know, the highest level of autonomy is basically unrealistic due to infrastructure problems and consumer behavior and just the fact that there's a lot of non-autonomous cars on the road.
Right.
And really for, you know, level four, I believe, is the highest for it to work, you basically need most of the vehicles to be autonomous. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you've got, you know, how do you rationalize, you know, something that's functioning, communicating with the grid, is driving itself with 78 Pinto or something. You know, you've got, there's all this stuff going on, and it's a messy situation.
I mean, we can't even keep the roads around here free of potholes.
Like,
I don't understand how we're going to have, like, this, like, super advanced infrastructure that's, who's going to pay for it?
Right. So it goes back to, this is going to happen at Disney World, right?
Or
is this
going to happen? Or like a golf course community.
Right, the villages.
The villages in Florida,
Where that autonomous company Voyage has got its vehicles rolling around down there, or someplace smooth like Chandler, Arizona, where Waymo's testing its cars.
It's really interesting. Like, when you think about it, it sounds so promising. And I'm pretty optimistic about it. But then you sort of come back down and you look at some of these realities. And I think it would take something so dramatic to change and to get us there. I mean, like, literally it would take, like, an enormous, perhaps unexpected climate change, World War III, something that would, like, basically change the fundamental, like, way of life for us to get there. So
if it's World War III, we're going to have to reinvent the wheel. So
that's true.
Let's hope that doesn't happen.
Yeah. I mean, something like Super Cruise, I think, is quite useful.
So this is the Cadillac GM system.
Right, where there's maps on board, topographical maps that know curves and inclines and declines. And, I mean, I think that's really advanced.
But you still have to pay attention.
You do, yeah.
And your eyes have to be not reading a magazine or...
Yeah. Well, there's so much going on around you when you're driving that you're taking all this stuff in. I mean, we have winter here. We have slop on the roads.
Sure.
You know, all the sensors are getting dirty. You have to clean them all the time. It's just, it's not realistic, I think, in this part of the country anyway.
Yeah, I find it, you know, since we've had real winter here in Detroit, I mean, like, backup cameras and suddenly I get this warning on the screen, you know, sensor failure or whatever. I mean, and so basically all it means is I have to go out there and just, like, take my my thumb and wipe off the lens on that thing. But, I mean, to your point, I mean, you just think about if you have an entire sensor array in your vehicle and one of those things goes, you know, is not working right. This is like,
throws the whole system off.
It'd be crazy.
Yeah.
All right, so we have a question for you, Greg. Ariel Brian Augustin, and I'm sure I massacred your name, and I apologize for doing that.
Okay.
Do you think it's a good idea for Ford to sell mostly SUVs rather than passenger cars? Don't you think a diverse portfolio would be a better choice than narrowing the offerings?
I think for the very near term, it makes a lot of sense to place a heavy bet on crossovers and SUVs because they're lucrative and they're what people are buying. I think the way they announced it was a very dramatic, drastic shift. Like, they're going to kill a lot of four-doors. I personally don't think they needed to go that far. I think having two, maybe even three sedans left in their lineup to fill even just like a niche sort of buyer would be a smart move. And a lot of people still buy Fusions. A lot of people still buy Focuses. I think, you know, they could have killed the Fiesta because it's pretty small. They could have killed the Taurus because it's a police car and a cop. You know, there's a couple things they could have sort of discreetly moved away. And I think just narrow it down to the, you know, those two I mentioned. And that would have been, I think, a better portfolio because I think some people still like sedans.
I mean, getting out a C car, I think, is super risky because for many people, myself included, a C car was their first car. And if you don't have that place for somebody, I know they have the little crossover now, the name of which escapes me, but no, smaller than that. Echo Sport.
Yeah.
But I think, to not have the Focus is, that's a big
mistake. So let me ask you, so Christy, so you cover Toyota very carefully.
Right.
And Bob Carter, who runs Toyota in the U.S. sales, Jim Lenz is his boss, so I don't want to Bob the leader here. But but Bob has said that he's very happy to continue to be in the sedan market, and thank you very much. You know, we'll sell, you know, what is it? They last year it was like 320 some thousand Camrys and probably nearly that many Corollas.
It was like 275 Corollas and about 300,000 Camrys. Yeah. I mean, they do a
whatever
good volume.
It is. So half a million units.
It's a lot of cars.
A lot of, you know, and they're like, okay.
Right.
So is he right?
Well,
I mean, I know that he's happy, but I mean, is
they've, through many decades of offering these vehicles, have built a reputation in both of these segments, which I think the reputation that Ford has in compact and midsize is not as strong. I don't think it's that bad. I think GM's reputation is probably worse. I mean, think about how many iterations of compact car General Motors has had. You had the Cruze, which is going away. Before that, it was the Cobalt. Then there was the Cavalier. Mm. You know, they've not been able to maintain a nameplate because every nameplate has
Nova before that, maybe.
Issues with reliability, and they hope people forget about it, so they rename the vehicle. I mean, Toyota's been out there with a consistent name and consistent reliability for Camry and Corolla. So when people think, you know, I want to buy a compact, they automatically think of Corolla or Civic. I mean, Honda, you could say the same thing for.
Yeah, so Honda continues the Accord and with the Civic. We're seeing, even though they're not doing bang-up sales right now in the U.S. market in terms of their passenger car sales, Hyundai's got the Sonata and
Elantra.
Okay.
Both very good cars, yeah.
Kia's got the
Forte and Optima.
Optima.
Yeah.
So they are not backing away.
People still buy these cars, and, I mean, to go back to the question, it does seem a little illogical to sort of throw out, you know, the baby with the bathwater here, you know, like Taurus, Focus, or excuse me, Fusion, Focus, pretty good products. Are they at the top of the segment? Not in sales, not in quality, but they're pretty good cars, and they do sell a lot of them. So it seems like that would have been a more measured approach, I think, to maybe grooming their portfolio.
Again, I think it's a Wall Street appeasement move, like, we're going to be, like, extra aggressive, and we're just calling it right now. Compacts and mid-size sedans, over, done. Nobody wants them anymore. We're going to put all of our bets on, place all of our bets on crossovers and pickups, and they look like, you know, they're really renegade. And
okay, so 5 years from now, do you guys think that everyone will be driving some variation of a crossover vehicle, or will there be sort of a reversal, you know, the pendulum will swing back more toward sedans?
Oh, I bet it swings back sooner than five. Yeah.
Really?
Gas prices go up. You know, people are going to want something a little bit smaller. Now, can larger vehicles be more fuel efficient? Of course. You know, we've got new alternative propulsion systems. You know, big can still be efficient these days. But I really think this is like an overcorrection right now, especially by Ford and by some other companies that are swinging really hard to just dial down on SUVs and crossovers. And I think there's still a market for small cars, too. People who live in urban areas, people who want something smaller.
Some people like the lower ride height.
It's kind of common sense.
They're more nimble. Cars are more nimble than
they
crossovers.
Drive
yeah. I don't know that I'll ever go back to 50-50. I think it might go to 60% light truck, 40% car. I could see that happening. And I mean, gas prices are going to go up. Crossovers are more efficient, fuel efficient than they used to be, but still in city driving, they get generally abominable fuel economy. I mean, you're looking at, you know, upper teens, low 20s, which in my book is really, is pretty poor.
You're seeing really weird small crossovers too now. Like the Echo Sport is one we were talking about. That's kind of an odd duck of a vehicle, you know. It's like lifted, but it's a hatchback. You know, we were talking about this in the office the other day. We were like, you know, I think the Fiesta is like actually a better product overall. It's, you know, it's more fun to drive. It looks better. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think the super small crossover segment is a little overrated, I guess.
So earlier this week, FCA announced that it is investing $4.5 billion in southeastern Michigan, with a big chunk of that, arguably all of that going toward creating more Jeep capacity and more big Jeep capacity, including Jeeps we don't even have yet, including a three-row Jeep that they're talking about, and the Grand Wagoneer, and on and on and on. So on the one hand, I look at that and say, this is fantastic, especially for this area to get that sort of investment. Okay. But, I mean, so to what you guys were just talking about, I mean, is FCA betting too much on Jeep? I mean, right now, Jeep is outselling every FCA product in the world, okay? So Fiat isn't outselling it, and, you know, Ram isn't outselling it. It's all about Jeep. But, I mean, what do you guys think about that big move that they're placing?
It's risky for sure. I mean, right now, it's smart business because people can't seem to get enough Jeeps. So I think last year they were the sixth best-selling brand in the U.S., which is pretty remarkable. But certainly, what are they going to have to offer if fuel prices go back to $4 or $5 or up to $5 a gallon? I mean, you know, I guess there are some hybrids coming.
Yeah, they said they'd have electrified versions, and then they protect themselves for having full electric versions on these vehicles.
Yeah. I mean, that's something, but lacking any cars beyond muscle cars, it's risky. It's for sure risky.
What do you think, Greg?
So I agree, it's definitely risky. I think in FCA's case, I actually think this is a smart move because they're going all in on their strength. Whereas Ford moved away from sedans that actually were still selling pretty well and they had a diversified portfolio, FCA really doesn't. They don't have a small car. So, you know, they have two choices here. They could say, hey, we could try and develop one, you know, which they did respectably with the Dart, but it didn't really sell all that well in the 200. Or they could say, yeah, we could do that. Or we're going all in on Jeep. These are big. These are capable. These are what people want. We're going to do that. We're going to try and make as much money as we can right now. And then when tomorrow comes, we'll figure out what our problem's going to be then. And I think, honestly, I think it's a good move. I really do. Jeep is, nobody else has Jeep. They do. So I think that's the way to go. And by protecting themselves with some electrification strategy, I think that could work out pretty well, too, because Jeeps could become, I'll use the cliche, Tesla fighters. But, I mean, I just think when you play to your strengths with Jeep, you're likely going to win.
So sort of a segue from that, Barry Rector says February sales are going to be down. Maybe they will. I don't know.
Okay, we'll find out.
They haven't been announced yet.
We've got like 8 hours left to go, right?
SAR down, auto loan defaults up. That's true.
Okay.
Longer loans, higher transaction prices. You know, I was reading a lot about there are fewer millennials that are making big investments because they have student loans to pay off. And so he's suggesting that there may be strong headwinds for the auto industry. What do you guys think?
About the February prospects?
Or about going forward?
Going forward. Well, we've been on quite the high for how many years now? I mean, this has been a long winning streak, and it certainly seems like we're overdue for a correction. And I'm reading the same stuff you're reading about, you know, people are up to their eyeballs in, you know, car loan debt and defaulting on loans and buying more than they can afford. Yeah, I think we're in for some rough waters.
I think it's likely that we're going to see a correction. But I, knock on wood, I don't think it's going to happen immediately. I think we could be looking at more like maybe end of this year, early 2020, when we might see much more of perhaps a reckoning or something. I think you're going to see sales maybe tick down a little bit, then we'll have some good months, then maybe they'll drop a little bit. I think we want to be careful not to sort of talk ourselves into a recession. Because, you know, you're seeing houses are staying on the market a little bit longer. Some of the other economic indicators aren't quite as strong as they were last year, a couple years ago. but things are still pretty good. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a catch-22. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right, so according to the control room, Elon Musk is teasing a Tesla announcement on Twitter. He says the news will come Thursday at 5 p.m. Eastern. The Tesla page says, quote, great things are launching. Any insights?
The wait is almost over.
Is this the affordable electric car or crossover? What's the next one to come, Model Y?
I was going to take a bet on the truck or the semi even. This is a curveball. Makes me think I need to get to work here.
So
it could be anything. It could be something about infrastructure. It could be
aerospace.
Right? Aerospace.
Although that's not Tesla. That's.
I think it's going to be the pickup truck. Why do I think that? Okay, Rivian's getting all the love right now.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, everybody is big on Rivian. I mean, we had that investment by Amazon into Rivian. There was the rumor that General Motors was going to invest in Rivian, and you know, so I think that Elon doesn't like the fact that he's not the guy who's getting all of the attention in terms of electric
vehicles. The headlines.
We've got this question here, sort of from Jeff Rainey, who's talking about Volvo compelling a potential electric car buyers moving from the Model 3, which goes to the Polestar 2 announcement that was made that, you know, they, in their press release, call out the Polestar 2 as being a Tesla fighter. You know, this will be the Model 3 fighter. Mm-hmm. And generally, these guys, you know, will say that to us, but they won't put that in a press release, right? I mean, but so yeah. I've just got to believe that it's got to be the electric pickup truck. I mean, we heard that Ford is thinking about having the electric F-150. Mm-hmm. So
electrified Silverados, I mean.
Yeah, so is Elon going to let that stand? I don't think so.
Not having any other information other than what we know right now?
Yeah.
Sure, I would take that bet that it's the pickup truck against the field over, you know, anything else it could be.
Seems like a good guess, yeah.
But it could be anything, you know. Mm-hmm.
Elon. We could stand all five. We could.
Yeah. Oh,
but it's Thursday, I guess it'd be today. That's right.
Yeah.
Oh, so apparently Elon also changed his Twitter name to Elon Tusk.
Okay.
And added an elephant emoji.
Is that so the SEC doesn't catch on to him?
See, that's what I was thinking about. I mean, you know, I mean, this thing of him tweeting that, what was it? He tweeted out that they'd be building 500,000 vehicles, and then he had to amend that, saying, well, right. He meant it would be a production run capability of 500,000 vehicles.
Yeah.
But he was supposed to clear that with his board and, you know, all that nonsense. But, you know, the
guys. You can't get in trouble on Twitter, can you?
Yeah.
It's foolproof.
Apparently.
It seems like you can't, right? It is, I see, 3:59. Mm-hmm. I promised you guys that we would be done at 4. So in the last 60 seconds... Mm-hmm. Got anything?
This whole issue of Europe putting speed limiters in all vehicles and data recorders, that's pretty crazy.
So is it a speed limiter or is it a data recorder that is going to know if you exceeded the speed?
That's a very good question. I've not delved into the fine details of it. The data recorder thing troubles me a little bit more than the speed limiter, although if you look at most new vehicles today, they probably already have a fair capability to track where you've been and what you're doing and how long you were doing it for. And
well, I mean, isn't it these insurance companies that are offering you great rates that, you know, all you got to do is just plug in their thing into the OBD2 port and lo and behold, it knows everything about what you're doing.
Yeah.
And they will then accordingly, you know, how many miles you drove, how fast you drove.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can get one for your car today.
Yeah. I had a relative that got one of those because she was looking for a lower rate. And as far as I know, she still has it. The speed limiters, you could argue, do you have the right to drive as fast as you want to drive?
So I think you do.
You do?
Sure.
It's always occurred to me if zombies were chasing you and they were really fast zombies.
Well, that's true. I mean, you'd have to have like emergency mode to like override it, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So wouldn't you just always use the emergency mode?
That's what I do when I'm late for, you know, auto line after hours and I need to get here.
That's right.
You know, pre-production and...
You hit that button. That says
zombie mode. Here we go.
Yeah. Yep. And it just goes. Goes really fast.
Cool.
Okay. All right. Now we're at 4:01, so... Sorry, guys.
Okay. This was fun.
Yeah.
Christy Schweinsberg, WardsAuto.com, Greg McLaurie, Autoblog.com.
All right.
As I say, check these guys out. They're good. It's worth your time.
There's also WardsIntelligence.com now.
That's too long.
Okay.
I mean, come on.
I'd get in trouble from my bosses if I didn't mention it.
All right, so wardsintelligence.com as well. Greg, you got another one?
WeAreAutoBlog.com.
Okay,
that's
so
who we
AutoBlog.com.
Are.
Yep. Simple to the point.
Simple,
I mean,
that's
eight
us.
Characters to the left of the .com.
I'll talk to them about shortening that.
Yeah, I wouldn't go down that road. I mean, but you gave them a shout out, and that's what's worthwhile.
Yeah.
So, okay, thank you all for joining us. John will be back here with me next week, and we appreciate your time this afternoon. And hope you enjoyed it as much as I did, because this has been a lot of fun. So, thank you.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems. And by BorgWarner, propulsion solutions that support a clean, energy-efficient world.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv. All right, so here's the after show part.
After hours, after hours.
Yeah, it's like the Oscars, sort of like an after party sort of thing. And
you should have some, like, you know, hors d'oeuvres or something.
Yeah. Or we could analyze.
Or celebrities.
Celebrities, yes.
All right, so I think I read today that this is the 100th day that Carlos Ghosn has been in jail.
Yeah.
That's stunning.
It is.
That blows me away.
And he's not, I mean, the Japanese legal system is totally different than ours, and he can't talk to his lawyers, or not as freely as you do in the United States. I think basically their method, their modus operandi is just beat you down until you confess to something you don't want to confess to. So
do either of you guys think that this has any discernible consequence on Nissan products in the United States? I mean, this is all we know. I mean, we don't know Renault products. We know Nissan products. I mean, is it going to make any difference, or is this...
Well, just him being gone, no matter the circumstance, I think will make a difference. He was, you know, a very tough businessman, and sometimes that resulted in less than ideal relations with their supply base. For instance, we've talked about this on the show before, that mm-hmm. they're not highly rated by their suppliers or thought of in good terms with their suppliers. You know, I would expect that to change. I think it seems like the leadership in place now is a bit more, you know, give and take, a little less
Dictatorial,
yeah.
I kind of wonder if there's any scenario where he would somehow return to power. I mean, we don't even know if he's going to get out of jail yet. But I mean,
I wonder if he does.
Right. I wonder if there is like this sort of like hero's return, you know, I don't know, for, you know, the CEO comes back in, takes back over. Because I think near term, you know, product plans are set for years in advance. It's not like, you know, the Altima is going to change tomorrow because he's in jail. But, you know, the new team's in place, you start to see some new philosophies, some new strategies. What happens next? You know, 2022, 2024. Mm-hmm. You know, I think we're going to see a different, you know, different Nissan, you know, different Renault.
I think you might see a pairing of the product lineup because we've seen in recent years, there have been some very long life cycles with vehicles in their lineup. And I hear that internally they struggle to maintain all these different nameplates, so perhaps we'll have fewer nameplates in the future.
Another interesting thing that happened, speaking of Carlos Ghosn, is that Carlos Tavares, who used to work there and wanted the top job and didn't think he was going to get the top job, who now has the top job at Group PSA, they announced this week that they made money with Opel. Something that General Motors was never able to do. Mm-hmm. And, I mean,
they did it right away, too.
Yeah, I mean, isn't that interesting? So here you have this guy who, you know, who comes in and basically,
well,
it's
to
a miracle.
Well, to be fair, they've cut a lot of costs, right? I mean, they've cut headcount.
Right, it was like 3,600 people in German plants.
And I think there's more to come, right? I mean, they're threatening more cuts to come. So, I mean, that certainly helps to... Mm-hmm.
But
to reduce
General
your workforce.
Motors could have done that.
Well, I don't think GM had the political capital to do that. Mm-hmm. I think they were always reticent to step in and be like the heavy-handed American overlord company. I think they preferred to be a little bit more of a, you know, benevolent leadership to their European arm. Even if at times under different GM CEOs, they have talked tough and they have done some job cuts and they've tweaked the lineups a million times, but it seemed like they could never quite go far enough, probably because GM was more focused on other more critical markets like the U.S. Almost any other market is basically more profitable mm-hmm. than European sales. So I think they just, GM did kind of struggle to really go deep enough in Europe. And I think, you know, you have this new leadership team in place over there, and they just were like, well, no, we're going to, that's overboard. No, not going to do that. We're going to cut this. We don't care what, you know, this company's board or Senate says. We have to do it. And they were pretty tough. Mm-hmm. It seems to have worked.
Yeah. So, in sticking with PSA, so Tavares also said that they're going to be bringing Peugeot back to the United States, and our old friend Larry Dominique is running PSA in the United States. But so I always thought it was basically a play that they would just do the, what was it, free now car sharing service?
Some sort of car sharing. I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head. But it's not with PSA cars. Like, it's something that they've invested
I thought they were
in.
Like Chevys or something.
But you're just like using your neighbor's car or something. I can't remember.
It's very nebulous.
The specifics of it. But, I mean, good luck to them. I think it's, you know, a very tough market to enter into. They would be bringing something different.
A French car.
A French car, yeah, which we don't have any of. So, I mean, that could be a point of interest for some people, though an Italian car hasn't worked out very well for Fiat, which, by the way, I wanted to mention that. I have a friend who's in the industry who has a leased Fiat, and he's struggling to get rid of it. He can't find any dealer that wants to take it. This is in Southern California. So perhaps there's some rough waters ahead. There's rough waters already for Fiat, but going forward, he's wondering, you know, mm-hmm. is this brand going away?
Jeep.
Change
the name of the company to Jeep.
I think it could work as far as Peugeot.
You think Peugeot?
I think it could work simply because I haven't, you know, dove too deeply into their plans, what they want to do here. I don't think they've really publicly said too much what they want to do here specifically. But I think if you look at, you know, cars now, they can just be like, rather than this like full line, take over the world product lineup where you have to play in every space, just make one car. Make two cars, you know, make it this like special French luxury good, make it really good. People might be into that. I think people have gotten less brand loyal in the car segment over time. I think people, you know, new brands like the startup electric car companies have sort of brought these new ideas and just this different perspective. And I think that's opened the mind of some consumers. So I think if they take a very start slow, narrow, precise approach, you know, sell this to like, you know, like do a lot of market research, sell the Peugeot whatever to these people, and then go from there. You know, maybe it's like one of their sports sedans or something that's, you know, very stylistic, very attractive. Maybe that's the play. Mm. Or maybe it's just an electric car. That alone will get people to look at it. It's like, hey, this is another electric car. Oh, it's actually backed by this huge French company. I might be into that versus a startup. So I think there's an opportunity, but they do have to get it exactly right. Because right now, they don't have a lot of brand recognition. No. And what they did have probably isn't good here. People don't remember Peugeot's all that fondly. Mm-hmm. So I think they have a chance. I don't know.
I mean,
mid-90s?
On for a while.
Early 90s?
20-some years they've been gone.
Yeah.
23, 26, something like that.
Probably long enough, but people don't remember.
The thing I would worry about, people will not know how to pronounce that word.
They won't, no.
And so...
That's not going to help.
Is there a level of embarrassment that somebody would have, like, you know,
they're going to have the commercial. Remember Hyundai, like Sunday?
Yeah.
They're going to have to put it in a commercial.
But it was always Hyundai. You know, because some people said Hyundai, some people said Hyundai. You know, but I mean, you were in the ballpark, right?
Mm-hmm.
Versus, you know, I'm going to get me one of those Pugats.
Yeah. I mean, Citroën rolls off the tongue a little better.
Yeah, it does.
Slightly.
But again, you know, that umlaut is just going to throw people off.
People call it a Citron or something, and that's not going to be right.
And,
they're going to have to educate the populace on proper pronunciation of their
name. But, in the aforementioned Larry Dominique, who is with them, oddly enough, previously with Nissan.
Mm-hmm. Nissan, True Car, I think.
Yeah,
a bunch of other places.
I think he was at General Motors before he...
Yeah, no, Larry's great. I mean, he's a great...
He's a product
executive,
planner.
And he's
Yeah,
the guy you'd want.
Residuals from True Car. I mean, it's,
I think if he has the right vision, he's got a shot.
He's a good guy. All right, you guys got to go.
All right.
Thank you very much.
And thank you.
Again, for all of you who stuck around, thank you.